This is Build It Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, and mobile web development. The show is hosted by Marco Arment. He is the creator, the founder of Instapaper and the magazine, among many other things. I'm Dan Benjamin. Today is Monday, November 26, 2012. This is episode number 105. We would like to say thanks very much to our three sponsors, Koku, Shutterstock.com, and SourceBits. We'll tell you more about those, as we always do during the program. We'd also like to say thanks very much to our bandwidth sponsor for November. This whole month of November, all those downloads you're doing are brought to you by MindNode, an intuitive mind mapping app for Mac and iOS. Whether you're brainstorming for your next project, organizing your life, or planning your vacation, MindNode lets you collect, structure, and expand all of your ideas. They got iCloud sharing. They got it all. Just visit mindnode.com to learn more.
I love the streaming API.
Oh, do you?
I love, because don't you remember the days before the streaming API?
Yes.
When you had to like wait and refresh your Twitter client and hit Command Shift R or whatever was refresh all.
Yeah.
When you do something, was it just posted that you wanted to retweet?
It's much easier now.
Oh, yeah. It's much easier to also, you know, be stuck with Twitter and constantly be distracted. And because now it's like, oh, I just finished reading it. Oh, now just something else just popped in. Oh, there's something else. And it never ends.
Yeah.
You unfollow 20 people. So anyway, hi, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing good. How was
this
your
show? Is this tune in for?
Yeah, this is the show.
Yeah.
How was your
Cyber Monday?
Yes, a big day, big Cyber Monday.
Yeah.
Are you out buying?
Is that what this is? No, that's something else.
I think it's different.
Yeah, a long time ago, in like 2005 or so, I was working in Pittsburgh, and I don't know how this came to be, but somehow some journalist was writing a story and wanted to interview me about online shopping. And what the story was actually about, if I remember correctly, was Cyber Monday. I'm sure you can find this somewhere in the I think it's the Pittsburgh. Is it the Post Gazette? Whatever the Pittsburgh big newspaper is, I think it's in that. And somewhere I have a PDF of it. But so they interviewed me. This journalist came by and interviewed me about online shopping. And I thought, so this is where my mistrust of journalists started, I think. I thought that the story was about how I would buy things online,
yeah,
you know, for myself. And then at work, I was also responsible for buying and assembling servers and their parts. So I was talking about, you know, buying server parts from Newegg and stuff like that. And the story that came out of that was that people are shopping for themselves while they're at work and spending all day browsing the internet shopping for themselves instead of working. And so somewhere in some news archive, there's an interview with me in 2005 or so talking about how I shop all day at work. And
oh man,
instead of working, I shop all day for myself. Isn't that great? I love journalists so much. That's another example of not all journalists are like this, but certainly there's a lot that are. Another example of, you know, they already wrote the story before they interviewed me, and they just, you know, they already had the slant that they wanted to go, and they just wanted somebody's quotes to stick in there.
Yeah, that's the weird, you know, I haven't. You're probably like me, and that once in a while you'll get like a journalist, and they'll come and they'll want something from you. But that doesn't happen a lot.
Oh, but there it is. Somebody got the link in the chat.
Oh, awesome! but when they do, when they do, it's really weird, because it's like they have a specific thing. Like they want a certain soundbite or they want a certain quote, and they're gonna get it.
Right. And by the way, you don't even have to have said the quote. So here, this is one thing that bothered me a lot. I remember this very clearly. This is supposedly a quote from me. The great advantage of shopping online is there are no pesky salespeople and you can choose your own music, Arment said. I'm not subjected to the Black Friday nightmare that is huge crowds and horrible jazz renditions of popular Christmas songs. Okay, first of all, I would never say pesky salespeople.
Mm.
That is not how I talk. That is not how I talked then. And I remember the sentence construction of the last part. I'm not subjected to the Black Friday nightmare that is huge crowds and the insertion of the phrase "that is" there, I would never say that. I would never write that. I don't talk. And like, it drove me crazy that not only was this whole article was the slant making me look horrible and not at all what I thought I was being interviewed for, but that I didn't even say that and that I don't talk that way. And so to have my words twisted in a way that I don't even talk in that style really drove me crazy. Like that, like, because not only does it make me look bad, but it's blatantly misquoting me. And that happens all the time in newspapers.
And what can you do about it? What can you do?
Nothing. The thing is, like, you just have to know that if you're being interviewed for something like this, where, you know, like, there really wasn't much of a benefit for me to be interviewed here. You know, it's not like they were asking me about my products or anything like that. At the time, I didn't have any products. You know, they weren't interviewing me for any reason that could be highly beneficial to me, except some kind of publicity, which I, being a naive 23-year-old, thought that was a really good idea. Oh, it'd be great to be interviewed by a newspaper. That's so prestigious. And, you know, that surely that can't be a bad thing. But of course, you know, when you're in that kind of position, what they're really doing is using you. They're churning through you, and they just need you to validate and lend credibility to their story that they already wanted to write. And it so happens that the stories they want to write are the stories that get attention and clicks and you know, start and have some kind of human interest slant that's cool to them. It's interesting. It's like same problem that we had for Tumblr. Well, it's the problem that David had at Tumblr, really, is that when we started Tumblr, David was like 19, which I didn't even know at the time. And all of the news stories for about its first year or two, and many of the news stories that came out even to this day, are all about just how young David was. This is why David wouldn't initially tell anybody his age, and it actually leaked out accidentally one day, thanks to Howard Lindzen. But he didn't want the story to be about how young he was. And sure enough, as soon as that became public information, every single story about Tumblr was about how young he was and not about Tumblr and not about the product and not about the site, not about the community. Like, and you know, it was all about this young kid started this, cause that's like a good human interest story that gets people to pay attention and people think that's cool. And that's way more interesting than, at least it's way more interesting to an average newspaper audience, than here's a website that lets you post things, you know? So anyway, you know, journalists, they're always out for their interests first, as everybody is for the most part. And you know, if you're getting something out of it, like publicity for your thing, there's a reason to talk to them. If you're just getting like, oh, somebody wants to interview me for the newspaper for some story they're doing, if you can't figure out why that's going to directly benefit you besides publicity, you're probably going to regret it afterwards. So anyway,
no press is bad press.
This great article. Oh man. Yeah.
No press and like, is bad press.
In fact, look, I don't think there's a single quote in here that I believe was actually said. Like the quotes from the CEO.
So what do you do? What do you do? I mean, how do you
sure he didn't say any of that stuff.
How do you defend against?
Well, you can. You know, you really can. I mean, if you're like a major public figure or a major company, then you can threaten legal stuff or something, but
and then they print a retraction on the back page of the thing that no one's ever going to see.
Right, it doesn't really matter. You know, the damage was done, especially like with online stuff. If somebody like TechCrunch publishes something wrong about you, that's going to be ripped off and syndicated and copied in so many different places that even if they correct the original article, what was originally published was already copied a million places and quoted a million places, and so it doesn't really matter. So you know, it doesn't any kind of like high profile online thing will have that problem too. So you really can't guard against this. Oh, Robert Half Technology is still around. I see their giant ad on this page. They're like a major consulting firm, right?
That sounds familiar to me.
They're the ones who I interviewed for right before I went to this job. And they told me that I didn't have any qualifications to be a developer and I should work IT instead. Yeah, I like them a lot. They were also the ones who said that this was a job interview and it was really just a consulting placement interview and they didn't actually have any jobs for me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I like Robert Half Technology a lot, in case you can tell.
Yeah, you have good, it sounds really good.
Anyway, so happy Cyber Monday. So where are you cybering today? What are you buying at deep discounts on the internet today when you're at work browsing the internet and not working?
I am not really aware that I'm going to be buying much really of anything. There are some purely by coincidence. One of my DBX 286s, which is one of the inline compressor things that we use, broke. Just died like this morning.
So am I like totally uncompressed all over the place?
No, I've got you running, not the one that you were in, but one of the ones that goes for the studio mics got screwed up. So I had a hot spare. that I used, but now I need to buy the replacement. And so I'll buy that. I don't really have anything else. What about you?
I was thinking about buying more RAM for my Mac Pro because it's pretty cheap at OWC right now, at MacSales.com.
Yeah.
They aren't a sponsor, but they should be. I buy all my RAM through them because they guarantee Mac compatibility pretty well. And you can get a little bit cheaper RAM somewhere else, but I've never had any problems with theirs, and I've occasionally had problems with other people, so I stick with them. Although Crucial is also a pretty good source, but for Mac Pros, I definitely stick with OWC. Anyway, they have I could double the RAM. I have two open slots, so I can go from 16 to 32 gigs for like $120 today. So I might do that, but I don't know. I've never had more than 16. I kind of wonder how much that benefits. You know, it's kind of hard to tell with OS X how much RAM you're really using in a way that more RAM wouldn't just be diminishing returns, because with most modern OSs, if not all modern OSs, unused RAM or RAM that's not in use by applications isn't just sitting there totally empty. Usually the OS uses it for disk caching or other buffers. That's why when you do the free memory command on Unix, it tells you like minus buffers and cache, then it's a different number. So if your applications are hitting up against your RAM limit and there's no room for those buffers, then yeah, you're going to have performance problems. But if I'm only using half of my 16 gigs now most of the time, and the other, you know, the other 8 gigs are being used for buffers, then adding another 16 gigs of buffers might be, you know, a pretty minor return on investment. So I don't know. I mean, how do you tell? I mean, I can like watch Activity Monitor. I can watch iStat menus. How do you tell if you need more RAM though, or rather if you could benefit from more RAM if you already have a sufficient amount?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things that it almost seems like a feel kind of thing, in a way of like when you're running, and that's not really an answer, but like if you're running a whole bunch of applications and things just kind of seem slow, and you know you've got a fast drive in there, and you know it's a relatively modern CPU, like it's RAM, right? I mean, is it more complicated than that?
No, I guess not.
I mean, I don't know. I RAM has not been an issue for me in so many years, because even the baseline Macs, and we've talked about this many times, for the longest time, the baseline Mac would have way insufficient RAM for anything. And it was just a given that you'd have to upgrade it, and Apple's prices to upgrade it were outrageous. So you would go to the Mac sales, you'd go to wherever, you know, OWC, whatever it was, Crucial, and you'd buy more RAM. And then you'd have to take that RAM out if there was ever a problem with your computer and you had to
take you bring it to the Apple store, and they'd be like, oh, we can't service this. Service it's third-party RAM.
Oh, it's your RAM. That's what the problem is. Well, no, it's a bad drive. Nope, it's your RAM. So you always had to save the original RAM to put back in just in case. But
yep.
Recently,
and after you sold your computer, the eBay would be flooded with a million, like 256 meg sticks for the most popular MacBook right. that everybody was trying to sell and nobody wanted to buy.
I've got 8 gigs of RAM in this 15-inch MacBook Retina. And it's for the stuff that I'm doing. I'm not doing anything these days that's super, you know, super, super like RAM intensive. It seems more than sufficient. This computer never feels slow. And this is the baseline machine. It never feels slow to me. It never feels like it's bogging down. I'm sure that if I'd gotten the 16, it'd probably be a little bit happier when I've got a lot of things going. But it seems fine. It just seems fine. And I don't know if outside of doing what you would call super pro stuff, like high-end video or image editing, you know, compiling things that are really, really large scale projects. And I mean, that might qualify for an iOS app too. You can tell me that. But it seems like the RAM that ships in these machines is sufficient these days.
Well, and a lot of the machines, I think they have to do that because a lot of them are not upgradable anymore. Yeah. If you look at, you know, I mean, certainly if you look at just the entire product line, what percentage of those are upgradable, then it's still a decent percentage. But if you look at like the product lines by what they actually sell.
Yeah.
Like what percentage of computers that Apple sold this past year have upgradable RAM? And that's a much lower number. You know, that's like, because you figure the Airs sell really, really well. I would imagine the Mac Pro is a rounding error. The iMac probably sells decently, but not nearly as well as the laptops. So, you know, we're looking at a computer lineup dominated by laptops. So you got to figure, all right, well, of the laptops, which sells best? And we've been able to pick up little hints and pieces and rumors here and there that indicate that the 13-inch non-Retina MacBook Pro has supposedly been the best-selling one for most of the last few years.
Yeah.
Because it is inexpensive and versatile. It still has the optical drive. It still has a giant hard drive. But it's small, light, and inexpensive. So, you know, that will have a credible ramp. But, like, the Retinas don't. The Airs don't. And I bet they sell a whole lot of Airs. The Retina, you know, like the 15-inch Retina probably is still, you know, a pro product, probably sells about as much as the 15-inch MacBook Pro always has. But I bet they have a whole lot of MacBook Air sales out there. So, you know, there's all these computers out there, and that's obviously the direction they're going. I think in the next few years, we're going to see the elimination of RAM slots on almost all of their laptops, if not all of them. So I think that's obviously the direction they're going. So they kind of have to ship it with enough RAM to be sufficient because you can never upgrade it. Which, by the way, has to be freaking out people like OWC and Crucial. But and you can kind of tell like in OWC's blog post about like the various SSD modification stuff, you can kind of tell they're a little bit upset and a little bit resentful of Apple's recent directions towards less upgradable and more custom parts. But anyway.
Yeah, I was looking for that post when you started talking about it, and this is how these guys really make a big part of their business is with this kind of expansion. And there are a lot of companies that exist just based on the fact that like people want to upgrade their machines. And with Apple's computers being especially popular with the hacker types, who are the, you know, developers, the people who are more likely probably to upgrade their machines. The fact that you probably can't upgrade a lot of them. Like, I remember there was a turning point when almost everybody that I knew there was, and I actually am thinking back to the first, I forget what the year was, the first RailsConf, which happened in Chicago. I think it was June, or it was 2006, I think. And almost everybody there was on a Mac. And it was this amazing thing to see it because, first of all, there was Ruby at the time was much, much less well-known than it is now. It was the first RailsConf. There was everybody could fit in like one room. And it was really cool. And like all of us were using Macs. And I remember at that time, like all of us, you know, we talked about where we upgraded the RAM and everything else. And now, like you mentioned, you know, you just get this one Mac that's this solid, sealed thing. Maybe you can replace a drive and that's it. And even just a generation or two ago, you were talking about how you could, you know, remove the super drive and swap it out to have a second hard drive in there and things like that. I even remember the old like Lombard Pismo style PowerBooks where you could pop out the drive on the side and put two batteries in. So you'd get like 3 whole hours of battery life on it.
Oh yeah.
You know, like that whole philosophy of being able to open these things up and change them out is going away. And that doesn't look good for the companies that exist to support that attitude or that philosophy.
And it's not like, you know, Apple being evil and trying to force everyone out of business. It's consumer demand. You know, if Apple can shave some weight and thickness off of a laptop by eliminating some covers and ports and swappable parts, then they're going to sell more of those because we want things to be thin and light and simple and reliable. Like we want all of those things. And so it's us, you know, Soylent Green's people, like it's us causing all of this, us, the market saying, you know, we're voting with our dollars and we're saying we will buy those thinner, lighter, more integrated products. And we don't care about upgradability as much. Same thing happened with cars. You know, people and the car nerds still complain about how everything's now electronic and you can't service everything anymore. Yeah, and cars aren't like these giant rectangular boats that they were like in the 70s. You know, like and they're way more reliable now. You know, the same thing happened there. Same thing happened in phones and tablets. Phones used to have removable batteries. Now many of them don't. They used to have all these, you know, hardware keyboards and extra antennas you could bolt on the side and all sorts of weird crap. And most of that stuff has either completely disappeared or has been greatly diminished in its prominence. You know, the iPad is now a lot of people's primary or only computer. you can't replace anything on the iPad. You can't do anything to it. You can't upgrade it. You can't downgrade it. You can't add storage. All you can do is use it, wait for it to break, and buy a new one.
Yeah.
That's it. And on in a lot of ways, that is certainly worse. You know, in a lot of ways, you know, it front loads the cost. If you want a bigger model, but you don't have the money for it, you know, like with computers, you're like, oh, I can buy the one with less RAM now, and then like in 6 months I can upgrade it.
Right.
And with the iPad, you can't do that. You know, you have to get it all up front. So it front loads the cost, and you know, it hurts resale a lot too. Like it hurts you, the person trying to get new things, because on resale, you don't get those big premiums back that you pay for the extra storage and everything. So like, you know, if I have, when I went from my old Mac Pro to my laptop, I had just bought like a $600 SSD and I moved the SSD into the laptop. And when I sold the laptop and moved back to a big Mac Pro, I took that exact same SSD and took it out of the laptop and put it in the new Mac Pro. And I was able to, you know, bring some stuff over, some stuff I had invested a lot of money in, bring it over to the next computer. You can't do that in this new world. You know, this Mac Pro that I have now is probably the last computer I'm going to have this SSD is going to work in. You know, so like there's all sorts of migrations we've made towards, you know, the integrated way. And there are certainly downsides, but overall, there's also a whole lot of upsides. We have way better products. They're way more reliable. They're way smaller and lighter. And there's just less things to worry about. Because when this stuff can get integrated in, like the RAM on my Retina MacBook Pro, as you said, the RAM is permanent, and it's soldered directly onto the motherboard. There is no slot, so that's one less thing that can fail. I mean, the chips can fail certainly, but you know, like they can't like get a little bit loose in the slot or get a little bit of dust in there and start behaving weirdly, erratically. That's probably more likely to happen than one of the chips going bad. You know, so like there's all sorts of little things like that that you just don't have to worry about anymore, and you have fewer choices when buying it. You don't have to say, okay, I'm going to buy the laptop base model from Apple, and then I'm going to go over to Newegg or OWC and buy this other hard drive, and then buy this RAM and try to figure out if that's the right kind of RAM, and how, you know, do I want to go, you know, 2x2 gig or 1x4 gig, and like there's all those choices that we had to make before, and that adds a lot of cognitive overhead and a lot of buyer regret afterwards if you worrying that you make the wrong choice, and when choices are removed, then it's actually more peaceful. It's easier to make that decision to say, you know what, I'm just gonna buy this model. I can choose like, you know, this one factor. I can choose like, you know, 8, 16, or 32, and I choose one of those and I'm done. I had no other decisions I could make. So I don't have to think about whether I got the wrong one or whether I made a wrong decision. I don't have to like get the laptop here and then open it up immediately and install a whole bunch of stuff in it and then worry if that's ever gonna cause AppleCare problems. Yeah. Like it's just an easier world that we live in now, even though there are those few downsides.
And that's, I think the important thing is to look at what Apple has done and the direction that they're moving. And I think for a lot of people, they say, no, I want to do all this stuff myself. And like you just described, you're building, you know, you used to build servers, you used to go buy stuff and put together machines. And that mentality still exists. And there'll always, I mean, I really always think we will have something like a Mac Pro. I feel like we'll always have that. Apple. Because there's,
yeah, I think it depends.
You think it could go away?
It really depends on the market and it depends on technological advances. Now, one thing, you know, I do want to address one thing here. I've seen this here and there, and I saw somebody tweet it yesterday, and I wanted to say something about it. A common sentiment that we always see is people saying, "Oh, well, you know, today you need this big Mac Pro, but in 2 or 5 years you're going to have that much power in your phone." You know, in your pocket,
right?
And you know, a lot of people assume that the market for like, you know, big desktop things is going away, or even the market for laptops, for that matter, is going away and moving towards smaller and smaller things. And I think it's more of like a shift, like we're shifting the biggest part of the market downwards. But as Syracuse said, I believe in last Hypercritical, there's a huge difference in the amount of power that these devices require and can use for their various processor and resources. So, and there's the power and space differences. So when you have something that is in a giant 50-pound case and plugged into the wall and can suck as much power as it really wants to, like a Mac Pro, you can cram a ridiculous CPU in there. And whatever technological advances have enabled the phones of the current generation to be really fast, if you're able to, say, make the die bigger, charge $800 for it, and make it able to sip 150 watts and be able to cool that quietly and everything, then you're going to be able to get way more processor power out of that. So it's not like the best way to get, or it's not like a phone being really fast is the fastest that generation of technology will be able to go. You know, you can always add more power capacity and add more, just bulk it up somehow, spend more power on it, spend more heat on it, spend more die space and cost on it, and make something even better for something that can be plugged in. So like that point will never exist where phones are as powerful as desktops can be of the same generation. Anyway, so long diatribe. I forgot where I was going with that. I don't know. Oh yeah, you were asking about the Mac Pro disappearing.
Yeah. Do you think it could possibly go away?
There's always going to be industries, especially things like video encoding and video processing, that just need so much processing power. You know, right now, the Mac Pro that we have now is still the fastest Mac you can buy. The Retina MacBook Pro is caught up in a lot of ways with those awesome Ivy Bridge chips, and I believe the next iMac will do something similar. So those are all well and good, but it's really like there's always going to be more demand for that resource. Like there's always going to be more demand for the processor power. You figure video right now, people are encoding it in HD resolutions. Well, pretty soon they're going to start encoding it at 4K resolution, which is, I believe, four times as many pixels, right? Doesn't it just double both dimensions?
It doubles both.
I think so. So yeah, so that like...
Well,
so
we'll get email if we're wrong.
Oh yeah, believe me. Yeah, I make no promise that was correct. But 4K video is way bigger than HD video. That at least I'm pretty sure is correct. And so like, that's always going to demand more stuff. And once we get to that point where we're encoding 4K and all the laptops are catching up in 10 to 15 years and they can all encode 4K as fast as the desktops, then we'll add something else and technology will move forward in some other way that will demand all that power. Maybe TVs then will want to be even higher resolution. Maybe it'll start doing crazy 3D stuff, holograms, who knows? Holographic storage has always been coming out in 2 years. You notice that? like Duke Nukem Forever. Didn't that actually come out?
That did come out. It was not good, apparently, but it did come out.
Well, there's a surprise.
Yeah. Let's do our first sponsor.
Yeah.
It's Koku. This is very cool. It's a brand new sponsor, so I really want you guys to check them out. It's a fresh approach, however you want to say it, approach for personal finance management. It's designed to make tracking your money simple and intuitive. It's available for both Mac and iPhone in the app stores. Both apps sync via iCloud. Okay, so your data will stay consistent, whether you're at home, whether you're on the go, work, wherever. It has a very cool, innovative, smart tagging system. It allows you to describe your financial transaction in a way that's meaningful to you. I don't know if you've ever used, I'm not going to name competitor products. It's not part of this. But I will say that you are often forced to use naming conventions and things that make no sense to you. This has a very cool tagging system so that you don't have to do that. You don't have to worry about buckets. You don't have to worry about categories or hierarchies. You use terms that make sense. And they have very powerful reports. It'll show you a personalized financial picture that actually offers you real insight into how you're spending your money. It's got smart lists, which are kind of like smart playlists, but for your transactions. Really cool stuff. They were actually recently featured in the Mac App Store. And the great thing is that currently both apps are on sale for half off. Usually the price is $29.99 for Mac and $4.99 for the iPhone, but they're on sale. $14.99 for Mac, $1.99 for the iPhone. Learn more. You can go to kokuapp.com. That's spelled K-O-K-U app.com. These guys are really cool. And let's make them glad they sponsored. Go check them out. Koku.
We got a good question from Matt Southworth. He said, on your last episode, you were talking about Stripe. And Marco asked, as an aside, is the rate negotiable? I was wondering if Marco could expound on what he's generally found to be negotiable as a small business owner and what approach he likes to take in negotiation. I think you may have talked about this in the context of a car purchase before, but what else? And my big question, do you know if anyone, a Megacorp, for example, ever get a negotiated rate with Apple for App Store or other purchases? All right. So first of all, Apple's rates are generally pretty non-negotiable. Like you can, if you're like a business purchaser, I guess maybe from that end, you might be able to get something like for, you know, get discounted hardware or something. I don't know about that end. But from like the App Store end that I do know about, as far as I know, nobody has ever gotten an exemption to Apple's 30% cut or to any of the major rules. You know, if you look like Newsstand and its various special subscription APIs, the auto-renewing subscription, the share information with publishers thing, that seems like that was a giant negotiation with big publishers and a bit of a giveaway to try to get big publishers to stay on iOS, to keep making apps, not just all switch to websites that paid through the web. So that was a big negotiation, but I'm pretty sure at no point did Apple say, we're not going to take our 30%. I think that was always on the table. Or off the table, on the table, off the wagon, on the wagon. I never know these things. All right, so I'm pretty sure, you know, Apple's pretty non-negotiable. And Apple's style is to do things kind of like that Newsstand thing, where if they're going to work with somebody, they will generally try to implement some kind of system for everyone to use that addresses that same need rather than, you know, just negotiate one thing with one company. And there are some exceptions to that, like you know, with the Facebook and Twitter integration into iOS, they don't let anybody integrate in those same ways, but those are like major features with one specific company in mind. Like that's a little bit different. But, you know, you're not going to have somebody like the New York Times being able to negotiate, you know, only a 20% cut instead of a 30% cut that Apple's taking, you know, so anything like that. And similarly with the rules, you know, Apple's very hard-nosed about the rules. They really don't let big companies walk over the rules. If they really want, you know, I'm talking about like App Store rules. If they really need some kind of change to be made, usually Apple will either just deny it, like in the case of Amazon and the 30% thing, or they will change the rules to make more sense for everybody. The one major exception to this is that Apple will ignore the rules and make exceptions for themselves. And the biggest example of this is Mac apps, App Store sandboxing, where Apple will have lots of their own apps that don't use sandboxing or that use like giant exemptions that let them do whatever they want that no one else could really ever get away with for very long. So Apple will make exceptions for themselves, but generally not for anybody who tries to negotiate with them. I haven't negotiated that much realistically in my life. I'm not the kind of guy who like goes to the grocery store and tries to talk down the price of the cheese. But although while I'm on the subject of cheese, deli American cheese is so much better than pre-wrapped American cheese singles.
Well, yeah.
I don't know why.
Did you just discover this?
Well, I always knew that like the egg sandwich that deli made tasted better than the egg sandwiches I made at home.
Mm-hmm. You were buying like the American, well, first of all, American cheese? Really?
There are a lot of things that really benefit from American cheese more than the other types of cheese. And I think an egg sandwich is one of the biggest examples of that.
Hmm.
You got one egg, one and a half or so slices of American cheese spread evenly across that egg on a New York hard roll, you know, a deli roll.
Hmm.
Which the thing that in New York, if you just say a roll, the thing that you're talking about, but the thing that if you go to Ohio and you try to find a roll, you won't be able to find it anywhere in the entire state of Ohio. That thing. Anyway, so I negotiated some things like for Tumblr. I negotiated some of the hosting cost. And my main thing was I negotiated the CDN costs. And hosting and CDN costs are very highly negotiable. The thing with figuring out whether something is going to be negotiable, it generally requires three conditions to be met or to be close enough. One is that there has to be adequate competition for your business that the person that you're negotiating with doesn't have all the power. Like if they're the only game in town for something, like Apple has all the power when negotiating things for the App Store because, you know, where are you going to go? You're going to go to Android where nobody pays for anything or are you going to miss the entire iOS market? Like that's no good. So Apple wears the pants in that relationship. They know that there are no alternatives or that you need them, you know. So, but you know, if it's something like a CDN where there's lots of competition in the CDN business, there's a million people doing very similar things. So, and it's pretty easy to switch between them. So you, the buyer, have power in that relationship. Also, they need to need your business on some level. You know, if somebody doesn't really need your business, doesn't really care about your business, then they're going to be way less interested in negotiating with you. And so, you know, some businesses are like, you know, the clerk at Best Buy doesn't really care whether you walk out of there without buying anything. You know, like the CEO of Best Buy might care, but the clerk doesn't. So like the person you're dealing with, they don't need your business, right? Some of the ways that you can tell if this might work in your favor are if you're dealing with somebody and this is the case with Stripe. If you're dealing with somebody who is not the number one player in a certain industry yet, or if they're trying to become that player, right, or if they're trying to grow, the number two player is usually way more interested in negotiating with you than the number one player, because they want to get bigger. They want to win. They, you know, they want to grow. Also, if your business is going to bring them a good amount of volume or money, like if you're a big client in some way, like Tumblr was easier to negotiate for because we were pushing so much data through CDN.
I can only imagine.
A very big deal. So, I mean, you know, we're talking like, you know, tens of thousands of dollars a month worth. It's a big deal. And so, you know, pushing tons of money through a CDN, and tons of data through a CDN, you know, if you're a big client or you can bring high volume, that matters. And then the main thing, though, about negotiation, besides the power relationship, the main thing is that you need to know roughly how big those profit margins are, because you can walk in trying to buy a car and you can say, I want this brand new Honda Accord, which is, you know, a $25,000 car. I want this car for $1. And they're going to laugh at you.
Yeah.
You know, like, then, all right, see you later. You know, we don't need your unreasonably odd business. You know, come back when you're sane. You know, so if you go to a CDN and you say, I want to pay a penny per gig, you know, like they're going to laugh at you unless you're Apple. You know, then maybe they can make something work. But, you know, like, you have to know how big these margins are. And so the information is very important. The internet helps a lot with this. This has helped a lot with car negotiations. Of course, they found ways around some of it, like incentives and rebates and all sorts of stuff. But for the most part, like, you know, when you're buying a car, it's useful to know the invoice price. You know, it gives you some idea of how much play there is in that price. Not that that's the bottom necessarily, but, you know, it gives you some idea. So, you know, you can't just ask for something completely unreasonable or impossible, because that just makes you look like an idiot. So you need to go into a negotiation like this kind of knowing how much room you have to play with, so that what you ask for is even possible, is even achievable, and you have some kind of credibility going into it. So, you know, all of these principles also apply to lots of other negotiations. One of the biggest things this applies to that we've talked about a long time ago is negotiating your salary at a new job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very, very similar, where, like, you know, if you need them more than they need you, you don't have a lot of power there. If you're negotiating a salary, you need to know roughly how much you're worth. Like, how much is it worth it for this company to have somebody doing this job? Like, that's like the profit margin equivalent here. Like, how much can they reasonably pay you without going broke, or, you know, before it becomes an easier thing to just wait for someone else to do that job for less money? So all of these things are very important in all negotiations. But critically, you know, you have to know what's possible, and you have to have some kind of power in that relationship. That's how you know what's negotiable. And you have to be talking to somebody who has the power to change the price. You know, like, again, like, if you're talking to a clerk at Best Buy, they have no power whatsoever to do anything. All they can do is sell you a magazine subscription and a really expensive cable. So, you know, they...
Gold-plated. You know, gold-plated.
Gold-plated, yeah, for reduced oxygen emissions or something. It's always a whole bunch of crap.
Yeah.
So, anyway. Oh, cables and Best Buy. Now, have they gotten to the point yet where they will sell you a service plan for the cable?
Oh, come on, no.
Have they? I don't know. I'm asking because
no.
You know, Best Buy is a store that sells service plans and cables primarily, and all the other products they sell are reasons for you to buy service plans and cables. Because they make, generally speaking, on whatever you're buying at Best Buy, if you buy one of their stupid cables with it, they're probably making more profit on the cable than they're making on the other thing that you're plugging it into. That's generally the case. Mm. Especially, and if you buy the cable and the warranty, if you're that much of a sucker, they're making a killing on you. And they're making, of course, very little on the TV that you're buying the cable and the warranty for. They have to at some point say, you know, well, we've somehow convinced you, you are such an incredible sucker that we convinced you that you need to spend $100 on this HDMI cable. You better protect that with a service plan. You know, you got to protect your investment in this HDMI cable. And it would be a shame if something went wrong. And, you know, after 7 months and our warranty is only for 6 months. So, you know, you can get a replacement plan for this cable and protect your investment. I mean, come on, we have to be at that point already, right?
For the cable.
If not, that'll be next year.
Mm-hmm. You're probably right. That's the sad thing is you're probably right.
Anybody here work at Best Buy? Anybody in the chat? I'm curious.
these companies, I don't know. And, you know, the only time I go to Best Buy anymore is like if it's an absolute urgent emergency kind of situation. Like I can't, there's nowhere I can go except there.
Again, that's a price negotiation, right? That's, you know, when Best Buy is taking advantage of people who are either very badly informed or who are desperate. Like for everything, but, you know, for prices of cables and stuff. Like, you know, if you're going to Best Buy and buying a Monster cable, Monster Cable, by the way, is one of the worst companies in the universe. Like ethically, they're just awful. But if you're going to buy a Monster cable, please don't sue me, Monster. I know you're very lawsuit happy constantly. So if you're going to buy a
cable,
are
they really?
Best Buy, oh my God, yeah. They they will go around threatening legal action against anybody who uses the word monster in any title of anything.
Really?
Like even if it's completely unrelated with other words, like it's crazy what they'll like. They have a crazy legal department. So please sue Dan. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you know, yeah. So they're taking advantage of people being badly informed or desperate. So if you go into Best Buy and you're spending $90 on a Monster cable, either you're an idiot and they convinced you, and you didn't do any research yourself. In which case, you know, it's I guess it's kind of sad. But it's kind of hard to feel bad for you. Like it's like if they were able to convince you to spend a whole lot of money on something and you didn't and you didn't really check to see if maybe that's not normal, that's kind of your fault, you know. as sad as it is, but although there's of course other issues there. Like what if you aren't capable of that evaluation yourself? And yeah, there's anyway. Sorry, but. You know, also if you're, you know, you said if you're desperate, if you will go to Best Buy and buy that gold-plated USB cable because you need a USB cable right now and it's 10 o'clock and the store's about to close and nothing else is open and you need it tonight, you know, then you'll go and spend $40 on a gold-plated USB cable with an extended warranty for another $40 because you need it right now. And that's, you know, that's generally where retail gets the gall to do these things. Unfortunately, retail has been doing things like this for long enough that most people have figured it out and will buy things online when they can. And then the retailers complain that Amazon is, you know, killing their business. So anyway, all right. That's, I guess we should probably move on to right. a different. You want to do the sponsor?
Yeah, I'll do the second sponsor. Shutterstock.com. We can find over 20 million stock photos, vectors, illustrations, video clips, and all that good stuff. I've told you about these guys before, but this is the cool thing. I haven't talked a lot about it. When you go there, you already know, okay, like I'm looking for the right image. They've got everything. They've got every kind of image out there that you could ever possibly want. And it's worth just having fun and looking around at this stuff. They let you make a light box and you can chuck all the stuff that you find into these different light boxes and organize them and come back to them later. You're going to get the best high quality version of all of the images and anything else that you put in there. It's more affordable than you think because they don't charge extra for the large files. You just download the image that you want in any size. You pay only one price. They don't nickel and dime you. And you can also, this is a cool thing, you can share pictures. So let's say you're working with a designer or developer. You've got a, you know, or either the flip side, you are the designer developer and you want to share the images and things that you're looking for with your client. You can do that with these light boxes that let you share. And they have an iPad app that lets you do it. They've got 24-hour support during the week. I mean, all the best stuff. You can sign up for free and do all this stuff for free at Shutterstock.com. And when you find the images you like and you want to purchase, the offer code that you're going to use is DanSentMe11, 30% off any package that you put together. Check them off, Shutterstock.com, DanSentMe11.
Another good question from Teddy Savoronos. That's a fantastic name. Savoronos? Yeah, I don't know.
You got me.
I was hoping that Marco might talk about the process of implementing Newsstand's unique features. I asked because I was subscribed to a bunch of publications before the magazine, New York Times, New Yorker, Economist, New Republic, etc., and only the New York Times has consistently implemented automatic background downloads, even though several of the others claim to support it. My question then is, what is the process of integrating with Newsstand like? Is it a complex and obtuse process that makes it very difficult to do correctly? I've heard that integrating with iCloud has been very frustrating. Well, I'm wondering if Newsstand is similar. Or if the publications simply aren't hiring the right developers or prioritizing doing this well. All right, so Newsstand APIs are a little bit buggy, which has driven me crazy, but you know, a little bit buggy. And the bigger problem is they are extremely poorly documented. The New York Times does use it. They don't even use it very heavily. They use like a very shallow version of Newsstand APIs, and they don't do everything the way Apple would like everybody to do everything. The biggest reason I think for this is twofold. One is that Newsstand only came into existence with iOS 5. And at the time, big publications were already having apps in the store and already having big audiences. And so for apps to retain iOS 4 and earlier compatibility, they have to either not use Newsstand APIs or they have to use them and implement, and keep implementing it the old way. So you have like two implementations of the same thing, which is generally not a fun thing to have in a program and generally a maintenance and bug nightmare. So if they wanted to, for the most part, they can only really use Newsstand well by going iOS 5 only. And only very recently has that even become a reasonable choice for somebody like a magazine that has to, you know, include everybody as much as possible. And by the way, the other problem with that, if you think about, and remember, this is why I'm not doing iOS 5 compatibility for the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Because they, if they already had established audiences on iOS 4, then they have to cut them off with iOS when they move that barrier forward. Like what if somebody's using an iPhone 3G? And you know, they have to cut them off when they move that barrier forward. What if they have an auto-renewing subscription? Were those out before iOS 5, the auto-renewing subscriptions? I forgot.
I do not know the answer to that.
I forget whether that might have predated Newsstand. I think they added that in 4.3, didn't they? Although, actually, that doesn't matter. 4.3 also can't run on 3Gs. Oh, well, maybe that's not the reason. But, you know, the double implementations and everything, there's good reasons for them not to use the Newsstand APIs. Plus, like, as I said, they're buggy in various things. There's still a bunch of really big Newsstand issue management bugs that I have yet to work around. I have yet to figure them out. All right. Anyway, so there's that issue. Oh yeah, sorry, I lost my place in the minutes. All right. The biggest thing also is they've already invested time and money into building these apps back during that time when Newsstand came out, when they couldn't drop iOS 4 compatibility. What is their motivation now for improving those apps, for reinvesting tons of developer money and testing and everything, reinvesting tons of money into improving these apps? If you think about their incentives, you know, they're focusing on making the content. I can now see this from the magazine to some degree, although I focus a lot on the app because I'm a nerd. But they're focusing on making the content and keeping subscribers up and selling a whole bunch of ads. Thank God I don't have to do that either. But they're focusing on that. They made these apps, or Adobe made these apps for them, or the Condé Nast group made these apps for all their publications, whatever the case may be. They made these apps. And so their incentive to go back and improve it is pretty poor. You know, from their point of view, they're probably not going to get a whole lot of new subscriptions from having implemented Newsstand properly. You know, that's a pretty minor thing. If you're subscribed to say the New Yorker, and suppose they don't already do this, I don't actually know that for a fact, but suppose that they don't already implement things like background downloads, that which, again, probably isn't true, but anyway, assume that they don't. If you're the New Yorker, people are subscribing to you because you're the New Yorker, because they know you, they know your name, they've sought you out. It works differently from, like, you know, feature checklist comparison markets in other types of apps. The New Yorker, you're subscribing to that, you're downloading their app because you want their content. There's no substitutes for that for you. There, you know, the, again, it's about the relationship of negotiation. What are you going to do? Stop reading this magazine you've been reading for years because they didn't implement background downloads? Probably not. And, you know, in most cases, probably not. So the incentives for them to do that are much lower and very different from, like, if RSS readers could add background downloads and one of them did and one of them didn't, and that's a very competitive market. You know, it's a very different business. So from their point of view, they built their apps a year and a half ago or more before all this stuff existed. And why change it? It works for varying definitions of works. So
it works in the way that they imagine it could work in the from right. the financial.
It works for them.
Yeah.
And it's pretty clear when you use almost every other publication's app. The New York Times one is pretty good. But when you use almost every other publication's app, it's pretty clear that they really don't care that much about the finer details of how the app works. And that's putting it as nicely as I can. Anyway, all right. You want to do, let's see, one more question, then another. We have one more sponsor, right?
Yeah.
All right. Let me do one more question.
Okay.
All right. Question from Martin or Martin Phillips?
Martin.
Well, there's a Y at the end. M-A-R-T-Y-N.
But the UK folks do that weird stuff.
Isn't that a German name? I don't know. Anyway.
I don't know. But like I know a guy, Mike, he M-Y-K-E in the UK.
Yeah, but was that his given spelling?
Who knows? Did he adopt
I don't know.
It's hard to tell with those guys.
And he keeps the I, too. He just moves it around.
I know.
All right. Question from Martin or Martin Phillips. I'd like to ask Marco what he considers suitable steps to take to protect licensed assets in an iOS app.
That is a great one because it's easy to pull that stuff out. How do you protect
any protected,
it?
I know that any protection method can be broken by a motivated person, but I'd like to make it a little bit harder than just unzipping the IPA file and doing a show package contents on the app bundle. Yeah, so I've had to do this before. One of the big things that I had to do a few versions ago is I was as part of my font licensing on some of the fonts I bought, I had to encrypt the font files in the app bundle as part of the license agreement. And so, you know, I had to look into this for that. And this happens a lot. A lot of people want this, or, you know, if you're licensing, say, you know, a database or a dictionary or something like that, you know, a lot of those people will want it to be encrypted or will encrypt it themselves and you'll have to decrypt it. Generally speaking, this is a lot like piracy protection in the way that you can do a few relatively simple things, and then anything you try to do after that has pretty severely diminishing returns. That, you know, and he's right, you know, any protection method can be broken by a motivated enough person. You know, if somebody really wants to get your decrypted font files or whatever, they will. You know, they'll figure it out. They will find, or they'll just pirate them for somebody else. But somehow they will get what they want to if they are motivated enough and skilled enough to hack into it a little bit. So you can't completely prevent anybody from doing this. You can make it really difficult and make it at least inconvenient for the skilled people to get to it. So I think what most people do, and this is what I did for this font decryption thing, is you use some kind of encryption method on it. And if it's something that requires some kind of decryption key, which I think all the good ones do, you somehow obfuscate that key in your code. So it isn't just like a literal string that would be dumped out by a strings dump. Like it's some kind of obfuscation method where you decrypt or construct the key in code. So it's a little bit harder to figure out what it is. Now, again, you know, if somebody is going to go through and you know, debug your process and hook into all sorts of stuff or you know, look at the binary code. Like if they're going to go to that length, they will be able to interrupt your code somewhere or dump memory contents from somewhere and figure out what that key is. You know, once you've built it, they'll catch it there. You know, there's all sorts of, I mean, this is such a huge rabbit hole. Like there's all sorts of of you know, various issues and various tricks people can do that you will never protect this completely. But like one of the best examples of this, if you look up the details of how the original Xbox was modded, how Xbox One mod chips worked. The Xbox One was supposedly this unhackable system. And there's this principle in security where like if somebody possesses physically the complete system and a system that has the decryption keys built into it somehow, like it's really hard to protect that from ever being figured out if somebody has complete physical access. So the original Xbox, Microsoft said this was unhackable. They'd never figure it out. And there was, I believe the trick was at some point, either the decryption key or the unencrypted BIOS was sent over a bus between two chips on the motherboard. And somebody actually like rigged up a whole bunch of wires and caught it and figured that out that way. Like there's so many different ways to attempt to protect things like this. But the fact is they have the entire app in their possession. They have the whole binary. They have all the code. They have whatever resource this is. So it's probably impossible for anybody, especially for anybody like us, any reasonable people who aren't security experts, it's probably impossible for us to really do meaningful protection here against somebody who's really good.
Yeah.
But, just use some kind of standard encryption and obfuscate the key a little bit, and that's pretty much all you have to do, because that covers your bases. If you have to encrypt it because of a license agreement, then they don't say, like, if it ever leaks out, we're going to sue you. At least they shouldn't, because they can't, because that's impossible. What they should be saying, and what my agreement said was, you just have to take reasonable measures to encrypt this. So don't just zip it and rename it and say, oh, it's encrypted because it's a renamed zip file. They'll never figure that out. That's stupid. But you can at least use some kind of basic encryption. There's tons of open source libraries out there. You can use Apple's built-in security APIs to do just really basic stuff. You don't need to go crazy. Just figure out do you want to use AES 256 or whatever the algorithm you want to use is. Like figure out, use something that people reasonably respect in this day and age, and obfuscate the key. And that's the best you can do. All right, one more sponsor and then closing up topics.
Sure thing. Last sponsor, SourceBits. It's a mobile app development house. These guys help you develop and design. We're talking about this kind of thing. I'm sure they know how to encrypt some stuff too. They develop and design your next application or your game, iOS, Android, you name it. They have over 300 programmers, interface designers, and folks that are ready to help you. And that's what they do. They're a big company, but they take small projects as well as big projects. They stand behind the idea that when you focus on brilliant design, that your product becomes your marketing, your customers become your advertising. They do all kinds of apps. They integrate all of these things together. And that's what's really cool about them is they've got the experience to do this. So if you show up and you say, hey, you know what, I have a small budget. I just have an app idea. They're going to work with you on it. You may come, you may be a Fortune 500 company listening to this. And we got some of those, Marco. And they may say, we want to do an app. We just, we don't want to do it ourselves. Or we're Skunkworks project inside of a big company and we just want to get this thing out the door. They'll do it. They've helped build more than 500 applications for multiple mobile, web, and desktop platforms. They've had 20 reach the top 10 in the application marketplaces. It's really great what these guys have, end-to-end product strategy. The best way to find out about it is just to go to sourcebits.com. When you're there, look at their project gallery. Look at the applications that they've built. You probably got a handful of them on your iPhone right now. Check them out. They're really great people to work with too. Sourcebits.com is a place to go to find out about it. Check them out. Let them know you heard about it here.
All right, last question for today. It's a relatively short one. From Maximilian Tagger. Hey, Marco, what is your experience with expedited app reviews? Does Apple Review put a hard cap on expedited reviews? My company's own app was just approved for one, but we don't know if in the future we should reserve them for worst-case scenarios like a crash on app startup. I've gotten a few of these. And the idea is you can go and file for an expedited review somewhere. They used to be, you just had to email them. Now there's some kind of form for it somewhere in iTunes Connect. They keep moving it, so I won't even try to tell you where it is. But generally speaking, I think the wording in their policy is left intentionally vague. Like you have a limited number of these and like a very limited number of these. And we will decide basically case by case whether to grant them. And so I don't really know what rules they use internally. I think it probably is also left intentionally vague internally as well. It's probably a judgment call.
Right.
So if you file for a fast review on every single app submission that you ship for no good reason other than you just want to jump the line, that's probably going to be refused pretty quickly. You know, you might get one through and then you'll be refused after that. Like, you know, they, I would imagine when considering this, they probably just look at your history. There's probably something, some kind of interface that their reviewers are going through that displays these requests, and whoever's processing them can probably see when you last requested one, how many times you've requested them, and you know, maybe what your history is, you know, how many updates have you shipped without requesting these, things like that. And they also want you to explain why. And so again, it depends on how severe it is. If you're like, if the problem is that some unimportant screen of the app looks kind of bad because some font is misaligned, I don't think they're going to care. And I don't think that's a valid reason to use it. But yeah, I think, you know, when, you know, he's saying like worst case scenario is like a crash on startup. I think that's probably a good use of it. You know, for me, I've used it. There were a couple of times when like I would issue an update that would crash on an older but still supported version of iOS. Like it would work fine on iOS 5, but crash on iOS 4, something like that. That kind of update happens all the time. People do this constantly because app review does not test on all the OSs. They only test usually on the most recent one. So you'll see this all the time. People will ship an update and then like you'll see in the description, they will update the description to say, please, if you're using iOS X, do not download this and not, a fix is coming soon. We've submitted it. Yeah. So, and then just a whole bunch of reviews. It crashed on a startup on my iPod Touch first generation that somehow still works. You know, that happens all the time. So something like that, that's a good reason to do it. You know, something that will affect a lot of your customers in a non-trivial way, in a severe way, then that's a really good reason to do it. As far as I know, you know, for me, I treat it as mentally, I assume that I only get one per year. And I know that there isn't actually an official hard cap like that because they will grant it if it makes sense. But I also know that, you know, I shouldn't really ever count on that being there. So I think assuming you have one per year is probably safe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can probably assume that and use that as your basis for deciding like, okay, is whatever problem I'm currently facing with this version that's in the store, is it worth burning this thing I only have one per year of? You know, how severe is it? You definitely should not assume that they'll grant it either. Like even, you know, what if they're just having a busy week? You know, like I've had expedited requests take like 5 hours to go through, which is awesome. But I also had one that took like 2 days to go through because they were just really busy. So, you know, you can't even really count on it being approved. And if it is approved, you can't even count on it happening like that day or even the next day. You know, it just might happen soon.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, it might happen in 2 days instead of 10 days. So again, it's all you have to decide. Is it worth even asking? And if it's that bad, if it's really worth even asking them about it, then it's probably worth it for them to grant it. Like then they will probably see the same problem. They will probably sympathize with you and say, okay, we'll approve this request. But if it's not worth that one burn a year for you, like if it's not that severe, then they will probably agree with you and not grant it. All right, I think that's it for this episode. What do you think?
I mean, that's good. You've said your piece. And you did it in 63 minutes.
Or less. Yeah, I'm trying to keep it, you know, an hour, even though I know you only have like 3 episodes left. So is it 3? What do we have left?
You said December 17th, right?
So yeah, there's 3 more after this.
3 more.
Yeah.
Plus the big bonus episode that you'll do each week.
What?
Going okay. Forward. The weekly bonus episodes you're doing. Or not. Okay. December 17th is the last one. And that happens on Monday of the second week of December. So yeah, three more. So people want to get in contact.
Well, I'd like to announce also that Google has not acquired the show.
No. Well, not yet. We're still in there.
We had issued a press release saying that Google has not acquired the show.
Right. So if you'd like to get in touch with Marco, he does not want your email, but you can absolutely get in touch with him on Twitter. Marco Arment, A-R-M-E-N-T. You can follow him on alpha.app.net. He's just Marco over there. And if you would like to send email, he may or may not read it, but I do. You can go to 5by5.tv/contact, and you can pick build and analyze from the list. And you will see there a little fill-in form where you can send email. And as you can see today, Marco did read and reply to the email. He may not. He'll probably reply to it here, right? If it's good.
I always respond to email.
Oh, really?
No.
Your response might be
not
no response, but
I always read my email.
So, go check it out. 5by5.tv/buildanalyze/105. I don't know if we have many show notes, but there might be a few in there. And we will be back a couple more, few more times next week. Have a good one, Marco.
You too.